Well, I was thinking about this song. Last week we talked about history, seeing God in our history. We want to see God at work and learn how to join him. I don't know. Somebody must have come up here and turned these little knobs while I was out of here. I think that people do that just to mess with me. Jack, did you tune my banjo off? Did you turn the knobs when you came up here?
What?
No. All right. So I was thinking about... I know I should have done this first, right? We're talking about history, seeing God in your history so that you can have a clearer picture of what God has in your future, that we look to the past so that we can see not just the present, but where God may be leading us. How he's worked in the past, he will work. He's worked in the past, he'll work again. We see history so that we can have a clearer picture of what our destiny is. And so this is an old song that kind of, it's a little bit tired, but it kind of has that idea. So we'll try it, okay? It goes like this. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. It's good enough for me. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. It's good enough for me. Well, it was good enough for the apostles. It was good enough for the apostles. It was good enough for the apostles. It's good enough for me. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. It's good enough for me. It was good enough for Grandpa. It was good enough for Grandpa. It was good enough for Grandpa. It's good enough for me. Now, we have these songs because, and I realize that's a little bit, you know, it's not like a theological, you know, wellhead of knowledge, but what I'm trying to tell you is it's this idea that we have this kind of stream of history that we're a part of, and that though in history, all through the history of the church, there's been mistakes made, there's been gaps in how we understood the gospel and how we projected the gospel, and sometimes people were doing really great things and at the same time they were doing bad things, or they're mixing their culture up in it, and so the gospel may not have been expressed as clearly or as completely as it could be, but if we learn the lessons of history, we can do a better job. Every generation, we can learn from the mistakes we've made, whether it's in missions or whether it's in how we, you know, the issues we get pulled into, and we're trying to do better each time to be more and more like Christ. You know, the old saying that those who don't learn from their past are doomed to repeat it. Those that don't learn from history are destined to repeat it. So that's really what is. It's last week we talked about this idea of you seeing your own, like we see as a country, some of the things of how God has worked and some of the things that have happened. We see as in church, how in individual churches or in the movement of the overall Christian movement, the lessons of history that come from that, and maybe even our own church. You have lessons from your family that are family histories, and a lot of you've never really sat down and thought about what is my family history in a way that you could really articulate it. Like this was, and maybe that would mean the history of your family's faith, or maybe how that interact with your journey, or maybe how they came here. There are two, as I said last week, there are two things that are the most significant shaping factors in your life. The grace of God, that's number one, and your family of origin. Like the fact that you're here and that you're in Washington and that you're in the United States, that has a lot to do with people that you may not even have known, but it's still a part of your history. And it has an impact on you. So as you understand it, as you think about it, and especially as you learn how to articulate it to those that come after you, there's lessons to be learned and we can learn them. If we don't, we keep repeating them. And making the same mistakes and making the same blunders and saying the same dumb things, right? And we don't want to do that. So in last week we talked about learning from the past, but now I want to take it where we ought to go with this. Because if God has worked in the past and he's working right now in the present, we also have to learn how to see God in the generations that come. What is the future? What is our role in that? Seeing God down through the generations. You know, Jesus talked a lot about this. He was always coming up with this with his disciples, trying to shift them out of the kind of thinking that they had. And he wants to do the same thing for us because we tend to not do this very well. Jesus said, "And whoever receives one such child in my name receives me." What Jesus was saying was how you treat the generations that come after you is how God will see you treat him. In other words, when God looks at you and he says, "Are you responding to me the way I want to be responded to?" He's going to look, one of the things he's going to look at is, how did you treat the generation after you? What did you do for them? How did you order your life in terms of that? Now, you said, well, that's a little extreme. Well, let me just read a series of verses out of the Gospels that comes up over and over again. And what that tells you is there's so much of it that it really is a dominant theme of what Jesus is really teaching. It's a core part of what the Gospel is all about. Mark 9:37 says, "Whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me. Whoever receives me does not receive me, but him who sent me." Out of the Gospel of Luke, it says in Luke 9:48, "And he said to them, whoever receives this child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For the one who is least among you all, this is the one who is great." And then in Matthew chapter 18, verse 1, it says, "At this time, the disciples came to Jesus and said, 'Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?' And he called a child to himself, and he set him before them. And he said to them, 'Truly I say to you, unless you are converted and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever receives one such child in my name receives me.'" Jesus makes this explicitly clear that how you respond to the generation after you, how you see God's work and respond to that, is going to be measured as the way you respond to him and the way you treat him and the way you see him and his value. It's really almost shocking. It's so radical. He's really saying that how we treat the generation after us, how we see God in them and what he wants to do and treat them and react to that, is the test of our faithfulness to God himself. So the question comes down, how do we do that? How do we show God that we really get it, that we see him in the generations, that we want to work in it? And I just want to take, I could start in a lot of different ways, but I want to tell a little story about how this church kind of did that. In 1998, when we had built this building, and there was a group of senior citizens, they've already passed on already, but there was a full row and half a row, and they could see, they were very concerned that we would not, they really wanted to be sure that we reached kids and reached preschoolers. And so they kept on kind of this over a period of 4 or 5 years, hey, we need more space. We need to have room for these kids and classes. And so they proposed that there was other people too, but this group of older folks, that we build the children's and preschool wing. And that building was built to be a preschool and children's wing. And that was its primary design. And so they wanted to do it. And I'm kind of reluctant. I'm not one of those preachers that wants to build like a crystal cathedral or something. I'm just not into that. It's just, buildings are great, but my mentality is it's kind of like the last thing. If you got to do it, do it. But there are a lot of hassle. There are a lot of expense. You got to maintain them. You got to fix them. People that are a lot smarter than me know how to build them. I have no idea. I mean, if I built the building, it'd look like something out of one of those reality shows about Alaska, you know? And so So I was kind of reluctant. I said, well, it's great, but it's really expensive. And, you know, guys, we have 14 cents in our building fund, you know. And they were like, no, this is what God wants us to do. And so we started praying about it. And gradually, I was aware that you're right. I mean, I don't know why it should have been hard for me. I had like 6 kids at that point, you know, or I had a bunch of kids, you know. And they're like, you know, we're talking to you. And so we planned and we prayed, and we had done this before in this first building, and we were going to build it by faith. We didn't want to have any long-term interest-bearing debt because, you know, we live in a place that there isn't, the economy's not good, and you don't want to be so strapped that you can't do anything. So we bought the land with cash. So we bought these couple of lots over here. And then it came time to decide. Like, now, in buildings, when you're going to build them with volunteers, which is what we did, you have to plan way ahead of time because you got to get all these teams to come in and all these people set up and get the right people on board. And so we were going to build in 2000, and in the spring of 2000, and we had to make a decision whether we're going to do it or not, give these people the definite. And at that time, we had some really well-intended, good people that really loved the Lord, but they were a little misinformed and maybe a little misguided. But you remember what was going on in 2000? People thought that the world was going to come to an end because the computers were going to roll over. And then when the computers rolled over, the lights were going to go out and the trucks were going to quit running. You know, if you had a chip in your truck, unless your truck was from like 1950. See, most of my cars were going to be unaffected at that point. They were all just junk, okay? So I was, and so people were really worried about it. And they thought that when the clock hit 12 on 2000, that was it. You know, I mean, everything's going to shut down. And so there's no point in us building a building if, you know, where the end of age has come upon us. You know, the electronic apocalypse was soon to come. And so I didn't know what difference I would really make. I mean, the power went out half the time at my house anyway, and I had wood stove. I mean, I'm telling you, I mean, I told you this story. I did call my dad, you know, because I was getting a little bit stressed about people being worried about this. And I said, my dad's an electrical engineer, and I said, Dad, what do you think? He goes, I don't think it's going to be anything. But he said, you ought to maybe take $3,000 or $4,000 out of the bank just in case. And I said, well, Dad, my bank calls that a felony. I was thinking, this was like a truck size hint for Dad to give me some cash, right? And he said, well, I got to go. And then he hung up. And I was like, I'm about to catapult off with all these kids into, you know, electronic oblivion, and he isn't even going to offer me any coin. But anyway, but in spite of all this, all seriousness, there was a lot of fear, and people were upset, and there were, like, preachers, and this is a lesson that I have had to learn repeatedly, but, you know, preachers ought to stick to, like, preaching. And not, you know, there was a lot of preachers writing books and talking about this that didn't know really anything about computers, you know. And so they were giving people advice, and it wasn't good. But anyway, I was too dumb to give anybody advice, so I just said, I don't know. But we prayed, and I was praying about it because it was really stressful. And these were good people, but they were kind of off on this whole thing and focused on this, and they were pretty like verbal about it. And I asked God, and I just prayed about it. One day I was driving down my driveway, and it was just like, came back to what I talked about last week, that we just determined that once again, what we had to do is whatever we're gonna do, we gotta do it together or just wait. Because if you build a building and half of the people are freaking out about it and mad and upset, then you get the building built and you don't have a community. So it was just like the Lord said, you know, let's wait. Just wait until we're mature enough or healthy enough to go forth and do it in a loving way. And so we did. And many people, I'll be honest with you, that group of seniors, they were really disappointed. They were like, it was kind of like I didn't have enough faith or whatever. And me, you know, but that wasn't my reason. It wasn't about faith. It was about unity. And so we waited, and we determined that we would wait 1 year and until we were ready. And it was agreed upon that we would do that. And we'd see if we were all still here, and the power worked and everything. Well, the day came, and I think it was a Saturday, and the clock rolled over, and it was like, nothing happened, you know? I mean, it was just like, I thought they'll get a little flicker or something, you know? Nothing happened. And then we met the next day, and people were like, wow, we're still here. And they drove their truck that had electronics in it. I drove mine that didn't. And the sound gear all worked, you know. And some people were disappointed in the sudden fall of toilet paper trading value, but you got to understand that people were storing up toilet paper thinking it could be like, you know, in the end of age, you know, if all the factories shut down, there's no toilet paper. That could be, you could buy a brick of gold with that thing because the gold won't be worth anything. Seriously, people had containers, they had bunkers of this stuff. And I actually got some really donations of free toilet paper, which around my house helped. Anyway, not for the apocalypse, but whatever. Anyway, I'm kind of getting distracted here, but anyway, that's enough out of you. Anyway. But I remember the night, so finally this all kind of played out, and I remember the night, and some of you that were here, I'm not trying to be, you can remember how it was, and people were stressed, and they were good folks, but just kind of preoccupied and fear. And I remember the night we finally voted, and so they were all here, and I said, you know, I've been praying about this, and we had to make the decision for 2001. I said, okay, I really think God wants us to do this. And that group of senior citizens all like exploded, like not mad, but like, it's about time that you did this, you know, because they'd seen that some of these things play out before and they thought it was kind of silly. And like, but and I think about that group of folks like Max and different people that have already gone to heaven. They were really focused on this. They were really intent because they were desperately afraid that what we would end up doing as a church is, you know, the big event for the week would be walker races down the center aisle of the church. They were afraid that as a church aged, we wouldn't have this ministry to kids and to young people, and they wanted to make sure that that didn't happen, and he was one of those ones that really led that charge. And I thought about what a great blessing that was. What a great blessing. And we have senior adults in this church that are such a great blessing in all that they do, to be surrounded with saints who see God in the generations, who get this, that this really has to be intentional. You have to think about it. And many of you that are here now, especially in this service, many of you have grown up in this church using that facility. It's just a facility, but you've grown up and that's made it possible. And many of you have brought your babies, and now your baby's babies are in the nursery, and maybe grandbabies, and they're being educated and taken care of in that space. And you, who'd have thought? And there are people that your kids are going to that. They're in the nursery, or they're in some of those spaces, those classrooms. And those people, you never even knew them. But I'm trying to tell you, that investment they made in your history was because they saw God working in the generation that was coming down the line, even though they never met you. See, that was a real step of faith. And it was really intentional. And so, so how do we show God? That's an example, but how do we show God that we see him in the generations that come? And I think it's really important that we learn the lesson from these elders, how they thought. Because you take a verse like this, and at this time the disciples came to Jesus and asked the question, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? I mean, think about it. Isn't that always the big question in every relationship, in every situation? Who is most important? Who in this marriage is most important, him or her? Or the kids, or this person, or that person, or which group, or which this, or which that, or which individual, who is greatest in the kingdom? That's a great question. In God's agenda, in God's economy of value and grace, what is of the greatest value, importance? And Jesus begins to grapple with that, because how you answer that question is really critical. And by the way, you by nature are not going to answer that question as correctly as you might think. It's very hard to keep on this. Because the way we generally answer it is, well, of course, I'm the most important. Deep down in my heart, the Lord has shown me I'm what really matters. That's very easy to go. We don't have to work at that. It's by nature. And so how do we demonstrate to God, when God sees what we're doing, we're on your agenda, that we value you. And number one is you invest your focus. This requires focus, because our focus gets a little bit off as we go along. It's so easy, as I said, to be self-focused, to be self-promoting, to be about what I can get out of something right now. It's really easy to do that. You remember Jesus, they asked the question, and Jesus said he did something that flipped them out, because this was a culture where kids were supposed to be seen and not heard. Yep, I grew up with that too. But that was the culture Jesus was in, but it was not the culture that Jesus endorsed. And so Jesus, they asked, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And he called the child to himself and set him before them. Man, that just messed with their minds. He said, this right here, this generation coming after you, this is what's really important. They're the ones that are going to be very quickly taking this forward. Because you see, we're just one generation away from extinction as far as the gospel is concerned. That's it. We don't transmit it well. So you have to invest your focus. You have to work at this. Secondly, you have to invest your prayers. And we've already talked about this at length some time ago about seeing God in your prayer life and looking and presenting it in that way. And this week you could pray for camp. You prayed for our kids' camp. You can pray for your grandkids and your kids, and to pray for them every day and to lift them up before the Lord. And this is part of what you're focusing on. That you are focusing on what is important to him as you pray. Thirdly, you need to invest your protection. This is really important. You know, Jesus talked a lot about, in this context, about not doing anything that can cause those that are new in faith and those that are young and vulnerable in faith to stumble. He said, whoever causes one of these little ones to believe in me to stumble, listen, it would be better for him to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. Now, I just want to say something about this verse. I don't even know what that totally means, but it doesn't sound good. Okay? I just want to say that whatever that totally means, you want to metaphor it or whatever, I just think it's a bad idea. Millstone around the neck, anything around that, similar. I don't even care if it's like a cobblestone. I really don't even want to go there, okay? So this is really important, not to cause any one of these little ones to stumble. And then he goes on, he says, but stumbling blocks are easy to run into. I mean, we can do it. Isn't it easy to stumble people? You don't mean to. You're just having a bad day, you're just not thinking, or you haven't really thought something through, you just react, or you get off on some side, your focus gets off. Woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks, for it is inevitable the stumbling blocks come. It's inevitable that this happens. But you know what Jesus says? Make sure it's not you. That takes some concentration. Because he says, but woe to the man through whom the stumbling block comes. It's if you're, and then he says, this is why you need to be really intense about this. You need to deal drastically with any behavior, attitude, sin that can be a stumbling block. He says, if your hand or your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. It is better for you to enter into life crippled or lame than to have two hands or feet and be cast into the eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out and throw it from you. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and to cast into a fiery hell. That's pretty intense. He's saying, he's not, hey folks, he's not, for those of you that are feeling a little shaky today, this isn't saying go chop off some body part, okay? So I just want to qualify that. But what he's saying is, it's so drastic that you ought to deal with this that it's like that. I mean, I don't know about you, but if I cut off my finger, I would be wrapping it in a damp towel and driving to ER. I mean, I'd want it sewn on. I'm not throwing it off. Well, he's saying, you ought to deal with it. Just get rid of it. Deal drastically with it. See to it that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I say to you, their angels in heaven continually see the face of my Father who is in heaven. For the Son of Man has come to save that which is lost. You get what Jesus is saying? You protect them. You protect this credibility. Man, negativity and ungodliness, and whether it's at home or in church, has a huge impact. Kids, young people especially, have a nose for hypocrisy. They pick up on it. So we have to learn how to not be stumbling blocks. One way you'll learn how to not be stumbling block is to learn how to apologize thoroughly when you mess up, not just fake your way through it. But a lot of people don't. And just to illustrate how long a bad scene can last in a church, my friend Cecil Sims, some of you knew Cecil, he was an old preacher from Texas, he was our executive director. He came and told us a story once. He said that years ago, way back in the day in Texas, I think it was around Lubbock, he did this revival, which is an evangelistic meeting. And in those days, they went from Sunday to Sunday. And so Cecil did this revival, and he said it was pretty much one of the best evangelistic events he ever did. He said they had like 40 baptisms, which is a lot. It's a big deal. And he said, and it went great. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, and then Saturday came. And there were these two sisters who were like in their mid-20s. They were either sister or sister-in-law, and they got in some kind of a, they had conflict between them, but they were both members of the church, sang in the choir and stuff. They'd been there all week glaring at each other, I guess. And as it turned out, Cecil said, those two ladies, I don't know, Annabelle and Susie Sue or whatever their names was, they got in a fist fight in the foyer right as the service started. Okay, and he said it wasn't just like a little pushing match and some words. I mean, it was a downright Texas brawl. I mean, his words were a two-fisted hair pull. That's what he called it. So, and they were like throwing books at each other and pushing each other. I was talking to someone this week, and he reminded me of this story. And Cecil said, and that pretty much was the end of the meeting. They still had the baptisms, and it was all good, but needless to say, it could have quenched the spirit a little bit, okay? So, roll forward about 40 years. He said he runs into this guy. He's in Texas, and he runs into this guy that says, hey, he was a member of that same church and was there that week. And he said, Cecil, do you remember that big revival we had in the church around Lubbock? And he goes, yeah. And Cecil's thinking, he's going to remember the 40 baptisms and what awesome, how heaven came down and glory filled their soul. And he said, the guy goes, you remember those two sisters that beat the tar out of each other? That was the only thing he remembered. And that is the nature of the way we're put together, isn't it? If we don't guard, if we don't protect the way we project the love of God, you know what happens? That's what people remember. That's what sticks. This kid, this guy that was telling him was probably 16, 17 when he saw that. He never forgot it. He remembered the Annie Bell and Susie Sue out there punching each other out in the foyer. That's all he remembered. And some of you have been through experiences like that in church too. You've seen battles and fights, and those things leave a scar on you. They damage you. And Jesus said, you don't be that person. You protect it. But so you need to invest in protecting this, in protection. Invest your protection and invest your wealth. This is important. And, you know, I just want to say this too. Thanks and an acknowledgement that we have a community of people in general, but many, many people that are very, very generous about working with kids and paying for kids to go to camp and paying to our, you know, scholarship, you know, camp scholarship fund, reserve fund. And I just thank you for that. But I also want to say, and there are lots of ministries you can be involved in that aren't just here. I mean, you can invest outside of here, like Compassion International is a great ministry. We have dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of kids that are sponsored through this church that people give $40 a month. Some people give, you know, sponsor two or three kids. But what it is, it's saying we believe we are investing our wealth. We those who have much are given much, not so we can hoard it, but so that we can bless those who have little. And so you do that. You make that transition and you make that investment, and that is just a great thing. And there's a reason why. Jesus brought it up over and over again. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in to steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. You know, you need to invest. God's blessed you, so invest it. And you know, the only money that you'll take to heaven is the money you give away anyway. You know, and you say, well, you know, and I don't know where you need to do it, but you need to make those heavenly investments because it's not going to last here. You know, you need to think about this and say, you know, in your will and in your planning and in your budget and your giving, you need to be that person who invests your wealth to be a blessing that will last. And you ought to do it before you ought to do it soon. You know, I agree with the preacher that said, do your giving while you're living so you're knowing where it's going. You ought to do that. So that you have a plan. You've been intentional about it. And so that there's a legacy. And some people give to kids' ministries or different things, whether it's here or somewhere else or someplace else that you see is really valuable. And that may be a legacy that'll go on for a long time. And then, you know, so you ask yourself, what are you going to take to heaven with you? You know, and people pray like this, oh God, please give me a heart for kids. You want to have a heart for kids? Get your wallet out. Because what you give to and what you invest in is what you're going to care about. If all you do is care about yourself, that's probably what you're investing in mostly. And then fifthly, invest your example. This is probably maybe the most important of all. You got to be that example. You know, as a dad or as a grandpa or as a, you know, you want your kids to care about the Lord, you got to care about him. You want your kids to care about getting along with other Christians? You got to learn how to get along with other Christians. And you want your kids to go to church and value it? You've got to value it. It's got to be important to you. You want your kids to know what it, you know, to value a life that's really lived out for Christ? Your life of humility and service and giving, your life of the way you treat kids is really a proof of humility. You know, how do you treat kids? Do they make you nervous? You know, I have people tell me, I've been around kids for years and they make me nervous. Look, I'm around kids all the time and they make me nervous. Right? You never know what they're going to do, you know? But the fact is that do you talk down to them? You know, kids will reveal your true character. If you talk down to kids and are harsh with them or mean to them, you know why you do that? Because they're not big enough to punch your lights out. Okay? You talk like that to them because you can get away with it. Not because you're... But if you are kind and humble and patient with a kid, now you don't have to be. Kids will put up with it. But if you are kind and patient and humble with a kid, it's because that's what's going on out of your heart. That's what's going on in your life. So kids will test us to see what's real in our lives. Now, none of us do this perfectly. That's why if you want to be a good example, as I said before, you've got to be an example of somebody who knows how to thoroughly and humbly apologize when you blow it, whether it's with your kids or your grandkids or people in church, people's kids in church. Please don't be that person. If that was my kid, I'd take him outside. You know, don't be that person. You don't know what they're dealing with. You don't know what other families are having to deal with. You could be help. You could, you know, you could pray for them. So, you know, we see God in the generations that it's valuable because he says it is. And if we really see him, then we're going to join him, because that's the key to the Christian life. Is you see what God is up to, you say, I want to join that. I want to get in on that. And what we do is we kind of pay it forward in our behavior, in our actions. And you know, you really have to be countercultural to do this, because we don't really live in a very kid-centered culture. We like to think we do, because, you know, Johnny's got a little toy pit, you know. But the fact is, you know, let me give you an example. And please don't get, those of you, you'll understand what I'm going to say, is please do not get all defensive. But let me give you an example. Seattle, King County area, there are 100,000 children and 150,000 dogs. Now, I am not saying you don't have good reason to love Fufu. That's great. I like dogs too. Okay, and you love your dog. That's the deal. You love your dog. Not everybody else loves your dog, but you love your dog. Just remember that, okay? And so now I can see you're already getting mad. He's a pet hater, I can tell. I'm not a pet hater. I love all the pets, okay? But I'm just trying to tell you this. We live in a culture that's more and more focused on other things other than children. On investing lots of money, big bucks. And what I'm trying to tell you is this. I think we all have to ask the question, what is the wisest thing we have to do in the prerogatives that Jesus gave us? I know that I'm like definitely walking in traffic here. But I'm trying to tell you, it doesn't matter whether it's toys or other things. What are we doing with those things that God has, our time and our energy? What are we investing in? We're countercultural. Jesus is calling his disciples, say, guys, get off the whole greatness thing. This is what you need to focus on. This is what's great. You know, revival is a young person's game. It really is. It's a young person's work. Almost all the revivals happened among the young, the big awakenings that took place. But as older people, we have to prepare the ground. We have to invest with a restored focus in what can happen and what will happen, that God's going to do it. Not get negative. These kids these days, the world's going to the dogs. Well, it kind of is. Invest the restored focus on what Jesus says is important. Invest with your prayers by praying for your kids and your grandkids and your great-grandkids, and if you don't have kids, somebody else's kids or somebody you've been chosen to invest in. Invest with your protection. Watch out for them. Invest with your wealth. Invest with your with allowing anything in your life, your example, allowing anything in your life that could stumble them. Guard against anything that could stumble them, and by your example of love, your example of welcoming them and noticing them and paying attention to them and taking care of them if you can, serving them, being humble. You know what? There's a great principle. When we honor God, Jesus said, the way you treat them is how you treat me. So when you treat the next generation a certain way, what happens is you're honoring God. And when you honor God, guess what? God honors you. That's what he says. I honor those that honor me. Man, being honored by God is a pretty amazing thing for a person or for a church or for a people, a family. God honors those that honor him. We forget how to do that sometimes, what really matters. It's more than singing songs. It's a whole set of priorities. So, see your part in history. You do have a part of history, but that history is moving downstream. And what's going to be after you? You see God in those generations.